500,000 deaths, a grim statistic, and so much more than a number.
We'll remember each person we've lost, the lives they lived, the loved ones they left behind.
President Biden speaking last night at the White House, surrounded by 500 candles, one for every 1,000 Americans who have died from COVID-19. The swaths of tiny flames flanking the White House South Portico was a visual representation of the staggering number of deaths, a number that reflects the way the pandemic has disproportionately affected the elderly and Black and Latino communities.
We often hear people described as ordinary Americans. There's no such thing. There's nothing ordinary about them. The people we lost were extraordinary. They spanned generations. Born in America, immigrated to America. But just like that, so many of them took their final breath alone in America.
The somber milestone comes after a particularly deadly January, but it also coincides with a decline in COVID-19 infections across the country. In reflecting on the lives lost, President Biden also looked toward the future. He called for Americans to continue practicing public health measures like masking, social distancing, and most importantly, getting vaccinated.
Let this not be a story of how far we fell, but of how far we climbed back up. We can do this.
I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. This hour, we're looking toward the future and what we now know about the virus and how we might be able to emerge from its shadow. I'm joined by two great experts. Angela Rasmussen is a virologist at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. She joins us from Seattle. Professor Angie Rasmussen, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Kimberly.
And we're also joined by Tara Smith, a professor of epidemiology at the Kent State University College of Public Health, joining us from Kent, Ohio. Professor Tara Smith, welcome back as well.
Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for having me back.
So I want to start out at that milestone, 500,000 people who have died in the United States from the pandemic. To paraphrase President Biden, there is nothing ordinary about this, both as in terms of personal loss, but also from an epidemiology standpoint. Angie, sort of walk us through what this moment means.
So this moment is an incredibly grim milestone from my perspective for two reasons. First, we've actually probably underestimated the deaths. Some people have estimated that it could be as many as 4 to 5 times more deaths that have gone uncounted as a result of the COVID pandemic. And that's really a staggering number when you think about it. And that's just in the United States. The other thing that I think about all the time with regard to this number is that these deaths were mostly preventable. If we had really responded effectively at the beginning of this pandemic, we wouldn't be remembering all of these lost lives.
Tara, what is your take?
Absolutely, I completely agree. And you know, I just keep thinking that this didn't have to happen. If we had had an effective response from the beginning, or really at any point throughout 2020. This could have been so many fewer lives lost. I also think about all of the inequality that we're seeing. This does not break down equally among racial and cultural barriers. That we are seeing many more lives lost in the Black and Hispanic community than in white folk. So that's something that we have to think about as well. That our country is still very unequal, and we're seeing that unfortunately play out during the pandemic.
And I want to hone in on that point about how the Black and Latino communities have been disproportionately affected, as well as elderly people and people in different income levels, but particularly that racial dynamic. Talk about the factors that are behind that. Are they economic factors? Is it environmental? Is it systemic racism? What's at play there, Angie?
I think that it's primarily systemic racism, which, of course, does lead to some environmental risk factors. It leads to incredible medical disparities that those communities have suffered. And it has led, as Tara pointed out, to a really unequal response for those communities, both in terms of their access to medical care, the quality of care that they're receiving, as well as access now to vaccines. We've seen already in the vaccine rollouts that there has been incredibly inequitable distribution of those vaccines to communities of color, and particularly to Black, Latino, and Indigenous communities. So I think that, this is something that has been building up really since 1619, but it is something that has really come to a head in this pandemic, and it has really revealed a lot about how far we have to go as a society.
So there is some good news, and I want to turn to Tara first to talk a little bit about that. It has felt like a brutal COVID winter, which is what I call it, COVID winter. But we are seeing cases drop. Tara, tell us why.
Yeah, that's a great question. And we don't know exactly why. There are a lot of different things that have been looked at as far as factors that are playing a role in this. And it probably is multifactorial that all of these things are converging. So one obviously is probably behavioral change related, especially to travel and gatherings. So we saw a spike coming in, starting in October, and then going through the Thanksgiving holiday into Christmas. So people were traveling more, they were gathering more with large families, and just spending more time with each other, probably largely unmasked. So that has probably decreased as we came into January and into February. The weather has also been worse, so that may play a role as well. Maybe again, not as a seasonality issue, but just again, as limiting some of these travel and gatherings. Mm-hmm. There's been some suggestion maybe there's a little bit less testing. I don't think that really is playing much of a role in that, but that may play a little bit of a role. We have vaccinations. Not enough, again, I think, to get anywhere close to herd immunity, but a lot of people that are highly exposed, such as healthcare workers, have been vaccinated. We've also had a lot of vaccination in nursing homes, which has helped to maybe stem some of the spread there and also lower the fatality rate, especially in those areas. And then, again, I don't think we've reached any kind of herd immunity, but maybe for those people who are highly exposed, the individuals who are regularly going out to restaurants and gyms and things like that, you may have a decline in infections in that population because you have reached perhaps some level of immunity in those individuals, the ones who are out and about, whereas a lot of the rest of us have been staying home or not as likely to be exposed. So we're not counting as much maybe in those demographics that are getting infected. So I think it's a number of those things and maybe more that I'm not thinking about right now.
No, it's okay. That's really helpful. And one of those things you talked about is the vaccine. And we have seen distribution ramp up, although imperfectly, to say the least. I can say this as someone who's tried a long time to get my octogenarian parents their first dose, which they did get happily. But enough so that it has spurred some optimism even from the White House. Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke to CNN's Dana Bash on Sunday about a light at the end of the tunnel, referencing President Biden's earlier remarks about a return to normalcy by Christmas.
Obviously, I think we're going to have a significant degree of normality beyond what the terrible burden that all of us have been through over the last year. That as we get into the fall and the winter by the end of the year, I agree with the president completely that we will be approaching a degree of normality. It may or may not be precisely the way it was in November of 2019, but it'll be much, much better than what we're doing right now.
So we're going to dive deeper into vaccinations a little later in the show. But Angie, is this where you expected us to be right now in terms of the rollout, in terms of how quickly the vaccination infrastructure is being set up?
I mean, I'm actually pleasantly surprised at where we are. That said, we still have a long, long way to go. But given where we were at in December and January, where there were quite a few roadblocks, particularly for elderly folks or folks who don't have reliable internet access or maybe comfortable with technology, we've really come a long way since then. So I think that we have now managed to vaccinate a fairly high percentage of people who are high risk and in the top priority groups for vaccination. I hope that that trend continues and that we continue to improve the efficiency with which we can roll out vaccines, particularly as we get more vaccine supplies in.
And Tara, we have heard about these variants. They seem really scary, and they can cause more severe cases and hospitalization. What does that mean for this effort to try to continue to keep the vaccine under better control as we've been doing?
Yeah, I think it just really emphasizes how important it is to really ramp up vaccine rollout and really encourage people to get it whenever it's available to them. So far, the vaccines that we have, and also some of those that have been approved in other countries but not here, they really all look pretty good for the variants. You know, not perfect maybe, but they should be very adequate as far as protecting individuals from infection. So we have to get those rolled out more quickly, and also while everyone is waiting, to still continue to mask, to distance, not become complacent, because those variants are out there and they are seemingly more transmissible.
And just in about 30 seconds or so, Angie, we're talking about vaccinating adults right now. Kids aren't getting vaccinated. How does that work?
So I think this is one of the factors that unfortunately there just wasn't time for on this accelerated clinical trial timetable that we use to authorize these vaccines. I think that it is an oversight. We do need to find out as soon as possible if we can vaccinate children as well as adults, because children clearly can be infected and spread the virus. So that's something we need to prioritize going forward.
All right, Angie and Tara, stick with us. We're discussing the future of the COVID-19 virus. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and we're talking about the COVID-19 virus and how it might become less of a threat. I'm here with Angie Rasmussen, who is a virologist at the Georgetown Center for Global Health, Science, and Security, and Tara Smith, a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University. And Tara, I want to go to you, going back to this issue of adults getting vaccinated. I know one thing listeners really want to know is what that means for kids, particularly what that means for efforts to reopen schools as quickly as possible. From an epidemiology standpoint, what are the issues and challenges there?
Yeah, so many schools either are reopened already or are planning to. Obviously, one big stumbling block is getting teachers vaccinated. Some states have prioritized those like Ohio, and some have not. So Ohio is working to get teachers vaccinated right now as part of the 1B group, because they do want to have teachers vaccinated before schools fully reopen. Even when schools reopen, obviously, again, children will not be able to be vaccinated. Those above 16 could, in theory, get the Pfizer vaccine, but it's not available to them yet, so they'll still have to wait. But anyone under the age of 16 has no vaccine available to them. So we will still have to continue masking, distancing, you know, doing all of these non-pharmaceutical interventions, and hopefully keeping children tested while we wait for vaccines for the younger age groups.
So one of the questions that I hear most from folks really involve what happens next, what happens in the immediate and not so immediate future, the weeks and months ahead. And I really want to focus on that with an idea of what's the goal here. So, Angie, is the goal herd immunity? Is the goal something else? And what exactly does herd immunity mean? What are we shooting for?
So herd immunity, or the herd immunity threshold, is the percentage of the population that is immune that will prevent a virus from spreading within that population. So this is based on the idea that all viruses need a host in order to replicate. And replicating is exactly what viruses do. That's their evolutionary mandate. They have to find a new host to replicate. If enough people in the population are immune, the virus can't find purchase. It can't find a new host to replicate itself in. So that's really what we are shooting for. We're trying to get to herd immunity. But that said, I don't think that herd immunity is necessarily the point at which we can go back to living our daily lives. We might be able to actually do that sooner and start relaxing some of the restrictions that are in place right now if we can reduce community transmission enough along with increasing immunization. So in other words, we can look to countries like Australia and New Zealand and Taiwan that have effectively controlled transmission without vaccination. In Australia, they've been dining in restaurants and not wearing masks and going to the theater and gathering with their friends for months now because there is really not so much, there's not SARS coronavirus 2 circulating in the population that can't be controlled through standard epidemiological methods like testing, tracing, isolation, and quarantine. So if we can do a combination of those things, increasing the number of people who are vaccinated while simultaneously bringing down transmission to a manageable level, we will be able to start living more normal lives before we hit that herd immunity threshold.
So I want to talk a little bit about how we understand and how we talk about where we are and where we're going. In this conversation, there have been a lot of projections, a lot of mights and maybes. And this is really about managing both the way we communicate and trying to manage our understanding and our expectations about this. And one of the consistent challenges for Dr. Fauci has been how to communicate the uncertainty and nuance about this pandemic, the way that it's ever changing. Yesterday, he spoke to CBS's This Morning, clarifying earlier statements about the possibility of wearing masks into 2022.
People ask you to make a projection when there are so many variables in there that are unpredictable. I didn't say we absolutely are going to be wearing. I'm saying it is quite conceivable that if we actually go into the fall and the winter and there is still a degree of virus in the community, despite the fact that many people have been vaccinated, we certainly will likely, very likely, be much better off than we are now. But it is conceivable that there will be enough virus in the community that in order to be extra safe, we may have to be wearing masks under certain circumstances.
So I'm going to ask you both a lot of questions about this, but I want to keep that in mind, the way that we talk about it and how we communicate that nuance. I want to keep that top of mind. And have you both found that challenging in your efforts to try to educate the public, Tara?
Oh, definitely. It's so hard to talk about something when, you know, you literally have papers coming out every single day that can, you know, slightly modify your knowledge. So, you know, I always try to be hopeful, but also realistic, I think, which is that line that Fauci also tries to walk, that, you know, these are the things that I hope we can do in the summer. You know, I hope to travel in the summer. It may be still masked, probably will still be masked. But, you know, I hope that community spread is low enough that I can feel safe to actually go to another community. So I think it is very tough because people also are getting, you know, have been getting down on this, and we've been experiencing pandemic fatigue for months. So it is tough to say the things that we still may have to be doing, as he mentioned, potentially into the fall, maybe into 2022. I hope not. But also to keep that hope there that if all of these things work out, if we have vaccination, if we get case counts down very low and have limited spread in the community, we could do these things. So I'm trying to be realistic but hopeful at the same time, which is not always an easy line to walk.
All right. Well, let's talk about the ways that we can lower community spread. I wrote that down. I feel like that's the goal that we're looking for in the immediate future. Angie, I want to point out that you have a new op-ed in the New York Times today called Does the Vaccine Stop Transmission? How to Understand the Difference Between Vaccination to Prevent COVID-19 and Shots to Halt Infection. And I want to open our discussion about what vaccinations mean. What will vaccinations look like in the immediate future and the far future? And what is the difference between vaccinations to prevent COVID-19 and to halt infection?
So let me tackle that one first. The vaccines that are currently authorized for use in the U.S. and actually some of the other vaccines around the world were all tested in clinical trials for the endpoint. Or what the clinical trial was looking for, efficacy, in other words, that would read out the fastest, that would provide results as quickly as possible so that we could actually start vaccinating people as soon as possible. In this case, that was symptomatic COVID-19. So all of the data that we have from the clinical trials tells us that these vaccines are incredibly efficacious at preventing symptomatic COVID-19. That means also that they are good for preventing disease, for keeping people out of the hospital if they do contract SARS coronavirus 2 infection. What we didn't look at in these clinical trials was the ability of the vaccines to prevent against exactly that other thing, infection with the virus. So it is possible to be infected with the virus and not have severe disease. We know that the vaccines work like that. What we still need to find out is how well they protect against infection, what some people call sterilizing immunity. Now, in the short term, we're getting new data literally every day. After my piece came out in the Times this morning, Pfizer published a preprint that is going to be a paper in The Lancet that actually shows that the Pfizer vaccine, in an observational study anyways, may reduce transmission or infection of people who've been vaccinated by over 80%. So that's incredible news. That suggests that these vaccines are also potentially very efficacious at reducing infection and thus reducing the ability of vaccinated people to transmit it to others. So I expect us to continue getting data like that that makes us more confident in the vaccine's ability to prevent infection, and that will guide policy recommendations and recommendations for how vaccinated people should be taking precautions in the short term. In the long term, my hope is that enough people will be vaccinated that we can start to relax those precautions anyways. Because even if the vaccines do nothing to prevent transmission, which again is very, very unlikely, if enough people are vaccinated, then nobody's going to be in danger of getting COVID-19, even if they do get infected with SARS coronavirus 2. So that is my long-term hope, and that really means that we need to double down our efforts now on communicating the science about the vaccines clearly and accurately to people so that they understand these nuances, they understand what's known and unknown, and they can feel confident getting the vaccines because we really do need as many people to get vaccinated as possible.
And Tara, help us understand what all of this means, what the virus can look like. Could it become eradicated, or will it become more like the flu we see now, something that's seasonal, something more like polio, rare but not completely eliminated? What are we hoping for?
Yeah, I think eradication is out of reach. Eradication means basically that it is gone from nature on the globe. So we've only done that as far as human viruses with smallpox, and it was a huge effort. I don't see that happening with SARS coronavirus 2, largely because I don't think the political will be there, but also because people can be infected asymptomatically, that I think it will be a very difficult campaign. We did choose to do that with polio, and the asymptomatic infections are really what has made that eradication campaign very difficult. So what I expect is that it would be more like our endemic coronaviruses, that it would still be there kind of in the background. It will still cause infections in individuals, perhaps still cause some deaths, but at a very a much lower rate than what we saw in 2020. And, you know, hopefully we'll see a declining rate in 2021 as well. But I don't think it will ever really go away. I think it will just become endemic in the human population, but something we can keep under control with vaccination.
So, Angie, I know we're still getting new information about this, but what might vaccinations look like in the future? Will we need annual vaccinations like the flu shot or some other sort of booster? Do we know that yet?
We don't know that yet, but personally, I think it's unlikely that we're going to need annual boosters for SARS coronavirus 2, like the flu shot, for a couple reasons. One, even though there are different strains or variants circulating right now around the world, there are not so many like with influenza. So influenza is around in nature in multiple species of animals, including migratory birds. And there are many, many different subtypes, which are all immunologically distinct. Those subtypes can get into other animals, such as domestic animals, livestock like pigs or domestic chickens and ducks. And then it can sort of mix up. It not only mutates, but it can do what's called reassortment, which coronaviruses cannot do. And that results in very unpredictable new emergent flu strains. When those strains start circulating in the human population, that's when we have to change our flu vaccine. And we need to do this annually because there are so many of those influenza viruses circulating in nature. We don't know that that's the case with SARS coronavirus 2. We do know that it can infect some different animal species, but there's no evidence at this time that it has established itself in any new animal reservoirs. So the likelihood that radically new viruses are going to be emerging all the time is pretty low. I think, though, there is a possibility that, especially as the vaccine rollouts are somewhat slow, the virus continues to circulate around the world in the human population, that we will see new variants emerge that may require a reformulation of the vaccines and another booster shot. Do I think that's going to be annually? Probably not. It's certainly a possibility, but I think it's right now it's less likely. It does speak, however, to the importance of rolling out vaccines as quickly as possible, but not just within the U.S., on a global basis, because a pandemic is by definition a global public health crisis. We need to make sure that the entire world is getting equal access to vaccines.
And what does immune escape mean, Tara?
Right. So it means a virus that would be able to replicate even in the presence of pre-existing antibodies, so that someone who has been vaccinated or perhaps naturally infected would no longer be immune to these escape variants because they could get around that host immune response and still replicate and still spread to others.
And do we think that that's a possibility with COVID-19?
I think it is a possibility. And again, that's really what they were looking at with the B1351, the South African variant, and also the P1, the Brazilian variant, is the potential for immune escape. They do seem to antibodies neutralize those variants less effectively, but according to everything I've seen so far in published papers and preprints, the vaccines will still work against them, or natural immunity will still generally work against them. So I don't think we're there yet, but again, the more hosts we give the virus to replicate in, the more chance that they can accumulate additional mutations that could lead to escape.
Now, one of the things we talked about at the top is how this pandemic has not affected Americans equally. There are disparities, including racial disparities. Angie, have we seen those sort of disparities? I know we've seen them in terms of access to vaccines, but have we seen them in efficacy of the vaccines?
Not to my knowledge. And one thing I think that's really important to point out here is that there is no biological basis for race. So there's no reason to think that a vaccine would work differently in a minority population because they are a different racial group or they are classified as a different minority population. The reason why vaccines may work differently in different populations or communities is because of existing medical disparities that are not a result of biology. They're a result of systemic racism. So that is something I think that's been very confusing for people, that vaccines may or may not work in the Black community or in the Hispanic community because of race. That's not really the case. It's not a biological difference. It's a difference in how those communities are treated in general and the medical disparities that they're already coping with.
Yes, and it's also a matter of trust in the medical system. Tara Smith, epidemiologist at Kent State, and Angie Rasmussen, a virologist at Georgetown. Both of you are going to stay with us. We're discussing how COVID-19 could become less of a grave threat and how we get to that point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Tomorrow on the show, we'll discuss Facebook's standoff with Australia over whether the platform should pay for the news. Last week, Facebook wiped journalism from its feeds. It's now promising to restore it. But listeners, Facebook users, and what would a Facebook without news look like for you? How would it change your social media habits? And should the tech behemoth have that level of power? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about the COVID-19 virus and how it might become less of a threat. I'm here with Tara Smith, a professor of epidemiology at Kent State University's College of Public Health, and virologist Angie Rasmussen at the Georgetown Center for Global Health in Science and Security. So will COVID-19 become a virus we can live with, rather one that constrains everyday life? Vaccines play a key role in getting there, as well as who is able to get the vaccines. And to talk more about that, I want to bring in another voice to our conversation. Ananya Banerjee is a professor at McGill University's School of Population and Global Health and the Dallas Lana School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. She's also the founder of South Asian Health Resource Health Research Hub. Professor Banerjee, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly. Thank you for having me today on Point with Angela and Tara.
So as we've been discussing already in this conversation, immunization, vaccination is really key. And for example, measles, it's still endemic in places that don't have access to immunization. So, but we can't only focus on immunization and access here in the United States the way that we're focused on it. It has to be worldwide. The view has to be worldwide. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Definitely. I think, you know, as we continue to think about how to bring down the rates of COVID-19 and, you know, really look to ending this global pandemic, you know, we need to start thinking about equity across the globe. And, you know, as much as we're starting to see, for example, in the US, Canada, and, you know, high income countries are, you know, readily beginning to start their vaccination rollouts, you know, hoping with the goal to, you know, control community transmission, to protect, you know, the populations in North America and also in the UK by early as, you know, September, we need to start thinking about low, middle income countries. And to make sure that they are not behind in the vaccination rollout and to ensure that, you know, across the globe that, you know, everyone is protected from the virus.
And so far, how have countries been doing that? I mean, again, from my view here in the United States, it seems we're very focused on where in the United States vaccinations are available. It doesn't seem to be that same level of focus on other countries. Is that cooperation happening?
It is happening. We know, for example, COVAX, you know, which is being led by the World Health Organization. We have various countries, you know, that have agreed to ensure, you know, 20% of each country across the globe are vaccinated. And there has been a lot of investment into COVAX. You know, for example, Canada, you know, has invested, you know, multi-millions of dollars and to really ensure that, again, no one is being left behind globally. However, given that we are starting to see delays in the delivery of vaccinations in various, you know, high-income countries, you know, who are unable to, you know, manufacture the vaccinations on their own and having to rely on, you know, international neighbors, unfortunately, we're starting to see countries in Europe, including Canada, now requesting vaccinations from the COVAX pool. And, you know, this has been really unfortunate. And again, you know, really, you know, shows that high-income countries, wealth, power, and privilege, you know, it's these countries that are going to get vaccinated first and unfortunately and be protected the most. And I worry, again, a lot of these low middle-income countries are going to be left behind, and it's going to take longer for them to be protected from the virus.
So measuring the equity when it comes to vaccinations requires data. And here in the United States, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley was a House sponsor of the Equitable Data Collection and Disclosure on COVID-19 Act, which would have required the Department of Health and Human Services to collect, disaggregate, and report racial, ethnic, and other demographic data on COVID-19 testing, treatment, and fatality rates. And last week, she appeared at a virtual event for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute to call for the same data about vaccine distribution.
More recently, I've been advocating for the collection of anonymized demographic racial data around vaccine recipients, because again, that which gets measured gets done.
Congresswoman Pressley is a Democrat from Massachusetts. So Angie, talk about the importance of data when it comes to vaccinations.
Well, I think data is really fundamental to that trust. As Congresswoman Pressley just said, if it gets measured, it gets done. That's absolutely true. We have failed completely to collect that type of demographic data throughout this pandemic, in part for political reasons during the prior administration. This is something that needs to be rectified immediately. If we can't even measure these disparities, how are we supposed to correct them? And if we can't correct them, then how are we supposed to build trust, which is a great point that you brought up earlier. There is a long history underlying the distrust in some of the communities of color for the entire scientific enterprise. If we're not even collecting the basic data to address those disparities and to build that trust, how are we supposed to look people in the eye and convince them that getting vaccines are in their best interest?
Yeah, I think that it is a crucial point. And Tara, I want to turn to you. I mean, on that issue of trust in communities, I felt like at the beginning of the pandemic, people attributed the lack of trust in, for example, the Black community to historic atrocities that were happened where Black folks were essentially experimented upon. But I think what we've come to find out is that it's not it's not just about that anyway. It's about how Black and brown folks feel they're treated when they're in the hospital, when they go to their doctors, about not getting equal care. I found it amazing that even people in the healthcare field, Black and brown folks in the healthcare field, were skeptical about the vaccine, for example. Talk more about the need to build that trust.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we think about things like Tuskegee and other things in the past as drivers of this, but you know, some people haven't even heard of those, but they've had their own experiences with healthcare that often have been lacking compared to white people. And we've seen, you know, Black physicians who are even unable to get equitable treatment, who have, you know, their own physicians who don't believe them when they go in with symptoms. So medical racism is still very much with us. It is not something we have exterminated or even really dealt with very well at this point. So, you know, trying to get trust to get people vaccinated is you know, going to be difficult. And it is both an issue of trust and right now availability. I mean, even many people who want the vaccines in the Black community cannot get them right now because they are not being rolled out to those communities. So I think we need to do both. You know, we need to, as was mentioned before, we need that data looking at where vaccines are going, what communities we're seeing them in, because we already know by some mapping studies that if you overlay deaths from COVID with places that are getting COVID vaccines, usually they are not the same places. And oftentimes that breaks down over racial lines. So we need to increase our vaccine rollout in some of these communities, as well as have people who are trusted in these communities available to answer questions about vaccines and to address any hesitancy that comes when the vaccines are available.
Ananya, speak a little bit about that trust issue in Canada and beyond in other parts of the world.
So we know that there is significant vaccine hesitancy, you know, particularly in racialized and indigenous communities, you know, in North America, and including Canada. And we definitely see that there is also vaccine hesitancy, you know, across the globe in low, middle income countries. And I think what's important to really understand it, it's not just because of cultural perceptions of the vaccination. It does play a small part, but as, you know, Angie and Tara, you know, have said, is that when we see vaccine hesitancy in racialized communities, you know, it's very driven by historic and present day racism and medical mistrust. And this is even more so that we in low middle income countries, because there is a level of hierarchy that, you know, exists depending on your class, on your caste, you know, the neighborhoods that you're living in your country, and seeing, you know, how funding is being allocated to various jurisdictions across the globe. And so we need to really start, you know, thinking of ways of how to build trust in our communities most effectively to really overcome their hesitancy. So, for example, in Canada, you know, we're seeing more and more public health officials, you know, working with communities, you know, trusted messengers, and trying to understand effective ways of ensuring that, you know, communities, you know, who are marginalized, you know, will be trusting of the vaccination, but also be able to access the vaccination in a place that doesn't create more trauma for them. And we know very clearly that our healthcare systems, you know, are triggering for many racialized communities in North America.
So we've been talking about the importance of words and how they matter and how we communicate about this. You use the word racialized as opposed to just saying communities of color, Black and brown folks, like I tend to say. Why do you choose that word?
So in Canada, we definitely are using the term racialized. I think, you know, in the last decade or so, you know, we are collecting more race-based data. And, you know, in Canada, we were really looking, you know, to our neighbors, right? Because you were more ahead of the game in terms of collecting race-based data and showing, you know, racial disparities, you know, between Black, Latino, and white communities. And now we have now clearly established similar trends when it comes to South Asian and Black and Indigenous communities. The term racialized, you know, we're using because we want people to understand, again, race is a social construct. And it's a process of how, you know, communities, you know, based on their biological features, you know, have been, you know, pushed to the outer edge of society, and how this process of racialization has really created, you know, social, economic, and health disparities. And that is largely driven, you know, by institutions of power that are, you know, dominated by white supremacy.
So, Ananya, I want to talk a little bit also. We've talked a lot about things that have been not going so well, but what have you seen in terms of what things have been going right? Are there success stories about how distribution of the vaccine has been adjusted to make it more equitable, for example? What have you seen?
I'm starting to see, you know, that the future of public health is local, and there are more national imperatives to effectively and authentically engage, you know, local communities who are marginalized and really bolster community-led solutions. You know, given that, you know, in Canada, you know, the National Advisory Committee of Immunization has clearly acknowledged that, you know, racialized communities need to be prioritized for the vaccination. What's been interesting that, you know, we've had a bit of backlash. And I think what people need to understand that, you know, racialized communities are not going to jump the queue. They're not going to run to be, you know, first in line because of this vaccine hesitancy, you know, that is based on medical mistrust. And so what's been encouraging to see, and I've been following, you know, the US and the UK quite closely, given, you know, the diversity makeup is similar to ours, though, you know, the communities may differ based on their ethnic minority identification. I think what's been really nice to see is that as public health officials are working with these trusted messengers, working with communities, we're starting to see a lot of partnerships with faith-based organizations. And so I know in the U.S., we're starting to see hospital church collaborative clinics, you know, popping up for Black Americans in the U.S. And in the U.K., they've started to have mosques, temples, churches, synagogues as vital and trusted points of access for racialized immigrant and refugee communities in high-risk neighborhoods. And I think it's really encouraging to see, you know, places of worship becoming natural partners for the delivery of wide-scale vaccination education, but also the uptake of the vaccination. And so, for example, in the UK, you know, they have readily had mosques vaccinating hundreds and hundreds of Muslim ethnic minority groups. And that is
and going,
a success story.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Going, that community involvement is really important. I just want to end by speaking about the future and remembering that we're not out of the woods. We did mark that grim milestone here in the United States of 500,000 deaths. One listener on Twitter says, as a PhD who explains stuff, I think it's really hard to explain numbers like one in a million. I want to turn to Angie in the few seconds we have left. How do you really get to where we are now and make people understand what we've been through?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure that I or anybody on this show or anybody at all has the answer to that. I think, though, that we need to think about, you know, the people that we love, and think about the fact that at least 500,000 and probably a lot more are never going to be able to spend time with those that they love as a result of this pandemic. And this was all preventable. So we need to think about how to minimize the toll from this point forward. We also need to be thinking about the future and how to prevent this from ever happening again.
And that's a great last word. Angie Rasmussen from Georgetown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kimberly.
And Tara Smith, a professor at Kent State, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me on.
And Ananya Banerjee, a professor at McGill University School of Population and Global Health, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kimberly.
And I am Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point.